Welcome, everyone. It's so nice to see you. And thank you for attending this LSE public event. For those of you I've not had a chance to meet, I'm Kate Miller. I'm an assistant professor here in the International Relations Department at LSE, and I will be your chair for this evening. I'm very pleased to be here to welcome Professor Patrick Thaddeus Jackson, and of course you, our audience, here in the auditorium today. Professor Jackson is Professor of International Studies in the School of International Service at American University, Washington, D.C. We're also joined today by Dr. Sophie Rosenberg, who is a fellow here in the International Relations Department at LSE, and we will be eminently joined, by Professor Laura Soberg, British Academy Global Professor of Politics and International Relations at Royal Holloway, University of London, and Professor of Political Science at the University of Florida, currently of delays on the Piccadilly line. But she will be joining us very shortly. In today's lecture, Professor Jackson will explore the meaning and deployment of facts, air quotes for everyone listening to this via audio later, within international politics. What do we make of alternative facts, including the seeming rise of conspiracy theory and the frequent partisan polarization of science? What should or shouldn't be considered science? Our speakers will also, potentially, reflect on Star Wars and the Lord of the Rings, and what ostensibly fantastic popular culture might tell us about truth in the present. For those Twitter users, the hashtag for today's event is #LSEScienceIR. This event is being recorded, which means I should have had my podcast voice on, and therefore will hopefully subsequently be made available as podcast, assuming we have no technical difficulties, which I am sure we will not. As usual, there will be a chance for you to put your questions to the panel following the conclusion of each speaker's remarks. I will let you know when we will open the floor to questions, so if you could raise your hand, and then when I indicate and the roving mic reaches you, you may pose your question. Please, of course, as usual, do provide your name and affiliation, and indeed, as we always say, keep your question brief so we can get to as many people as possible. And so, with that, Professor Soberg is here. It's actually extremely well timed, and so we will leave a moment for Laura to get ready and take her seat, and I will hand over to Patrick. Thank you very much.
Cool. Let me first ask the AV tech, should I be worried about the red light up here? Is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's recording. Okay, cool. I wasn't sure whether it was like going to turn into, you know, Hal's Eye from 2001 or something, you know. I can't do that, Dave. No. Hi. Welcome. So my title comes from the eminent contemporary philosopher David Byrne in his lovely piece, Cross-Eyed and Painless, which occurred on the Talking Heads' album, Fear of Music. And that's where Facts Don't Do What I Want Them To comes from. And I like the title of that because it captures, I think, one of the central intuitions that we have about facts, which I want to try to preserve throughout the course of this talk. But I also want to explore some of the ambiguities of exactly this particular position. So my topic, that resonated really impressively. Very cool. Because I know I'm going to drop something at some point, so you know, let's get that going. What am I going to talk about here tonight? So my topic here: facts, factuality, so-called alternative facts. And if you take nothing else away from this particular lecture, I hope you will not use the phrase alternative facts in the future, but you will use the phrase I will give you as a suggested alternative to alternative facts. And what should the proper kind of response be for scholars, for academics, for people who think of themselves as being kind of in the knowledge business? And that's kind of what I'm going to be talking a bit about this evening. I want to give you a few kind of instructions for the listener to kind of think about as I go through this. First of all, much of what I am going to talk about is going to approach these subjects from the perspective of the philosophy of science, not so much from the sociology or psychology or political economy of knowledge. And what I mean by that is I'm going to be looking at questions of logic and logical form and what makes for a proper warrant for factual claims. Therefore, hopefully, by defining that in a particular way, leaving an awful lot of room for other kinds of empirical researches on how something comes to be believed or why certain things are circulated or how it is that certain things become established as if they were true. And the panel that Kate has nicely put together has a number of people who are actually going to be talking about other aspects of this. So there's a nice complementarity, if you will, between the kinds of things that we will be doing. Second, most of the empirical claims that I make or things that sound like empirical claims tonight are actually going to be ideal types. They're going to be stylized. When I speak in broad, general terms, you will start thinking of exceptions, and that is perfectly fine. But you should then think about, okay, what do these exceptions do to the overall argument? Do the kinds of dynamics that I'm talking about, are they still in evidence in admittedly mixed actual cases and events? And the third thing is, I'm going to talk occasionally about we and us. And I'm not going to qualify it every time. But what I mean by we and us is I mean people who are working within and are at institutions that are kind of framed within the broadly, what you might call European and USian tradition. And I say USian because there are Americans that aren't in the United States. It's like South America and stuff. So it's an ugly word, USian, but let's face it, sometimes the US is an ugly country. But within that tradition, if you are coming from other traditions or are knowledgeable about them, what I would ask you to do is think about whether anything I'm saying here has resonance in those other traditions. Points of contact, points of interchange there. I am largely going to confine myself to what I know something about, which is this kind of philosophical heritage, which I think informs the sets of educational and political institutions that we often find ourselves within here. With all that by way of preliminaries, it would not be a talk by me if Weber didn't show up at some point. And so look, there's Max Weber, the eminent German sociologist, in whose work I find a lot of interesting inspiration for talking about this stuff. And in particular, a concept that Weber introduced 100 and some odd years ago to talk about the world in which we live, which other people would sometimes call the modern world, all sorts of issues with this question of modern. Weber argued that what we live in, and I agree with them on this, we live in a disenchanted world. Now, what does that mean, to say that we live in a disenchanted world? Literally, the word in German that gets translated disenchantment is the word Entzauberung. Anybody speak German in the audience? Literally, Entzauberung means de-magicification, right? Taking magic away. Think of it as more of a campaign than an empirical description. To disenchant the world is to insist that explanations and other kinds of accounts for phenomena have to be dedicated to the elimination of mystery and mysticism. They have to be replace those elements with things that are more rationally calculable elements. It's a peculiarly kind of post-Enlightenment, kind of colonial crusade, but it forms the world in which we intellectually have kind of grown up. Disenchantment, in many ways, means confidence that phenomena have to be accounted for in a way that doesn't make reference to gods, demons, or the supposed causal efficacy of moral virtue. The world in a disenchanted environment is inherently meaningless. It is a world of facts. So if we think about Weber's famous example, this is the streetcar. So you're in a streetcar, trolley, again, he was writing 100 years ago. Imagine now you're on the underground, right? So you're in a train, and the train car goes, and the train car stops all of a sudden, for instance, if you're on the Piccadilly line. And you don't say to yourself, oh, it must be because someone forgot to sacrifice something to the proper transit authority god. Or it's a punishment for the evil things that we on the train have done. Instead, no, we look for a rational explanation of why the train stops. And even if we don't ourselves know all of the physics and engineering involved in how a train works, we know that if we were to ask people, the answers we would get would involve things that are rationally calculable and learnable by these kinds of systematic rational procedures. Same kind of thing with the computer, even though we all like to swear at our computers sometimes because we think they're possessed, and we like to talk as if they are doing things perversely. We know at some level that that's not a sufficient explanation. We keep looking for something else. Now, of course, in the social sciences, we apply that same kind of disenchanted knowledge production process to phenomena like Brexit, like the war in Ukraine. It would not be sufficient to submit something to a peer-reviewed journal article in which you blame the war in Ukraine on evil. That wouldn't work because that wouldn't show up as a proper kind of account in this scientific discourse that we inhabit. We like to think that policy ought to be based on something other than questions of belief. So this disenchantment sort of forms the intellectual and practical world in which we live, and it privileges, this is where it connects back to this question of science and facts, in a world that is disenchanted, a world that is relatively disenchanted, science is privileged as a mode of knowing because what it promises to deliver are facts, which are impersonally true, not the product of belief, not the product of faith, not the product of divine intervention, but somehow impersonally compelling. That's kind of the promise that we get in these different modes of scientific reasoning. And in a disenchanted world, to say that you're doing that automatically gives you a certain kind of epistemic and rhetorical privilege. So that's kind of the situation that we find ourselves with then. Now, this leads to some rather interesting and somewhat perverse outcomes, which I want to talk a little bit about, but I do want to give you one sort of cautionary note right up front that I'm going to come back to a little bit later in the presentation, which is, we have to remember that this notion of the world being disenchanted is not an empirical description. No one actually lives all the time in a fully disenchanted world. Even we don't. So there are ways in which you can see, even in our politics, in our popular culture, a kind of resistance to this disenchantment that shows up. Bear that in mind. I'm going to come back to that after I finish talking a little bit more about the kind of parameters of what it means to have factual or factic, as I will call it, discourse. But I want to turn, and I hate transitioning from Weber to this person, but you know, sometimes you have to do these things. For people who don't know, this is Kellyanne Conway. And Kellyanne Conway was a senior advisor and counselor to the Trump administration, frequently called on to try to explain to the media some crazy thing that somebody in the Trump administration had said or done. As you can expect, she was very busy during the Trump administration. She was called into service a lot. You may remember, or you may have repressed this particular memory, but right after the inauguration of Donald Trump in 2017, there was a bit of a controversy that broke out about how many people had attended Trump's inauguration. So the official press secretary, Sean Spicer, made a set of claims about the number of people who came to Trump's inauguration, which suggested that more people had come to Trump's inauguration than to Obama's inauguration. Promptly, people started publishing photographs, aerial photographs, of the area in Washington, D.C., where crowds stand. And you could see very quickly from the photographs that at the Trump inauguration, there were lots of open areas, and at the Obama, there were none. There were no open areas. People were like hanging from light poles, right? It was super crowded. When Conway was asked about this, what she said was that Sean Spicer had given alternative facts to the ones that were being reported in the news media. And that's a phrase, the first time I heard it was like, well, there's something kind of offensive about this phrase. The idea that facts are nothing other than your own opinions about what you would like to be true. You're claiming the authority of something that is supposed to be impersonally true, and you're like turning it into a personal tool. But the more I thought about it, what was kind of interesting about this claim about alternative facts was the claim was not, it was not like a straight up charismatic claim, like the facts say this, but whatever, come and follow me, the prophet of new whatever. That wasn't the claim. The claim was not ignore the facts. The claim was those facts aren't facts. I have real facts. I have the actual fact. There was a kind of disclosure that was built into this idea. Here are the real facts about what's going on. So they, the unspecified they of the mainstream media, are somehow lying to you. That very rhetorical posture, betrays a certain kind of connection to, and dare I say, even affection for, the idea of a fact. They just want to grab it and do something with it that is a little bit different than what the rest of us would like to do with notions of facts. So I think that we should not refer to these things as alternative facts. And yes, you could refer to them as lies, but I don't think that really gets at the real sort of depth of what's going on here conceptually. I think we need to think about these things as counterfeit facts, by which I'm using the analogy here of counterfeit money. What is bad about counterfeit money? It purports to be actual money, and it appropriates something that is kind of publicly circulated for private purposes. And in a way, this notion that there can be alternative facts try to do exactly the same thing. And says, okay, facts, which are supposed to be impersonally true, except I have impersonally true things that support me, and you somehow don't, right? So it's like an attempt to shortcut the whole process and say the facts are whatever I would like them to be. And that, I think, is deeply troubling. That said, it is in some way, I think, a consequence, and this is what I want to try to clear up here in the rest of the talk, it is a consequence of us expecting both too much and too little from facts. And we expect both too much and too little because we live in this disenchanted world where facts and factuality have this kind of call, this claim on us. And then when it doesn't work out, we get very disillusioned. We sort of go to the other end and we say, nah, there's no such thing as a fact. So too much, right? We expect too much from the facts. We expect a fact to be a sufficient ground for action. We expect that if we have facts, then that should tell us immediately what we should do. Right? The fact should be so compelling that it would make us do one thing rather than another. And of course, we think this because I think we mistakenly believe that facts are some kind of independent feature of the world when they're not. Facts are claims that work within particular kinds of linguistic communities. And that matters. That matters a great deal to what we think they're actually good for. But the other extreme is also problematic, right? Facts are, because if we decide the facts are supposed to be independent features of the world and we suddenly discover that they're not, we go, oh, well, a fact is just somebody believing something or claiming it really strongly. And that, I think, is equally problematic. And that sort of shifting to the other extreme where somehow all assertions become arbitrary is not necessarily what I think we need to do here. So what I think is a better way to go is I'm going to try to give a little analysis of what it means to be engaging in factual discussion, what a fact is, that avoids both of these problems. And my hope is that by kind of cleaning this up philosophically and conceptually, what it does is it will show us that the realm of fact is a lot smaller than we think it is, and a lot of the things we think of as facts actually need explanations that can't really be reduced to questions of fact. And they have to be sociological, they have to be political, they have to involve media, they have to involve other things. So by cleaning up this realm, I'm hoping to sort of show by contrast what this other one is like. In order to do this, as was my usual wont, I will pull up my other favorite German speaker whose last name begins with a W, and that would be Ludwig Wittgenstein. And Wittgenstein, who I still think is the most important philosopher of the 20th century, people can fight me on that later. Based on some of Wittgenstein's work on language and meaning, I think we can derive a much more useful way of thinking about questions of fact. So I will posit, and then I'm going to elaborate a little bit, a definition. This is not a quote from Wittgenstein, this is based on some of Wittgenstein's work on language and meaning, but it is my phrasing. That a fact should be understood as a descriptive claim with which competent speakers of the relevant language cannot disagree. Cannot disagree, not don't want to disagree, can't disagree. That's really what we are talking about when we're talking about something that has the impersonal epistemic authority of a fact. Now, we need a word to describe claims that might be factually true and might be factually false, but in any case are part of that sort of discourse of things that could be decided on a factual basis. And the difficulty is the standard word in English we would reach for this is the word factual, but the word factual already has truth built into it. If you call a statement factual, you're already assuming it's true. And so to say false factual would be kind of weird. Turns out there is a word in English, thank you OED, that actually does get at what I would like, and that word is factic. and it's a way of describing a particular kind of claim, a particular kind of language game that a claim is playing. A factic claim is one that could and should be evaluated as to whether it's factually true or factually false. You could contrast this, if you wanted to, with aesthetic claims, poetic claims, spiritual claims, things that we say that we don't intend to be evaluated based on their factual truth or factual falsity. There are lots of those kinds of claims. When we're talking, however, about factic claims, what we mean are claims that we think can actually be decided on this sort of factual basis. Now, the key point is that factually true and factually false are judgments that are established and made inside a community of competent speakers. They are not reflections of some independently existing reality that necessarily impinges itself on all speakers at all times. That claim doesn't even make sense, because what language could you possibly use to say something like that? You instead say, when we are talking about a claim that is factual, we mean a claim that we as speakers agree on, and we agree on to the point that we really can't disagree with it. So if I say who should I say something to here? I need something really, really, really uncontroversial. All right, so I'm gonna hold this object up right here. And if I say this is a cat, clearly that's not correct, right? Nobody's going to say this is a cat. We might have a little discussion about whether it's properly called a coat or a jacket or something, but no one would say it was a cat, right? Because in our language community, the proper use of the word cat doesn't apply to that object, right? That's just a standard kind of thing that we know as people who are competent speakers of language. And if I said to you, no, that's a cat, either I don't know how to speak language properly, or I'm making some kind of humorous or poetic claim of some sort that shouldn't really be evaluated based on its factuality. Now, language games, when we exchange meaning with each other, Wittgenstein argues, imply a kind of social form of life that we are embedded in. We negotiate with each other as we kind of exchange counters for meaning. Form of life, therefore, implies a particular kind of community. Saying a fact is drawn within or stated within a language game suggests that facts are facts for communities, for communities that share a language. If they don't share a language, they can't come to consensus about something, and they can't come to consensus in a way that would make it impersonally compelling for all of the members of that community. Now, I want to point out here, I want to underscore this, when I'm talking about competent speakers, I do not mean that competence is something that can be legislated in advance. Competence, Wittgenstein reminds us, is something that is negotiated every time we speak. I use a word. You either accept my use of that word or you push back against it. Over time, we evolve, we negotiate particular ways of using words. And then once there is an approximate consensus, we then kind of stand on that consensus when we're socializing new people into this particular language game. And you all know this, not maybe philosophically, but you all know this practically, because you all have friends and you have private jokes with your friends, and particular words or phrases that you can use that will set off all kinds of laughter and memory because you know what you're talking about. You know exactly what you're talking about. Other people don't, because they're not part of that group. They can't competently use that particular allusion in the same way. Competence here doesn't come from the outside. Competence is something we interactively produce as a community. We continually renegotiate what the rules of proper language use are. Which is why when somebody grabs the dictionary and says, no, that's what this word actually means, what they're doing is they're attempting to assert a particular claim about what the word means or trying to get you to follow this. It's not like the dictionary is somehow objectively true, right? It's a record of the way we use words. It's a record of common use. Again, this is like linguistics 101. What is interesting, though, about these claims that I'm arguing, the sort of realm of factual claims that are factually true, is that if somebody disagrees with them, then it provokes a question about whether the person knows how to use language properly. So maybe you're just learning and you actually didn't realize that the word for this is not cat. So now I need to sort of teach you what the proper use of that word is. And so if it provokes that kind of a response, we may be in the presence of something that has factual validity. Now, the other important part of what makes something a fact is that facts are descriptive. So, does anybody know what this is? Anybody know what this object is up here? No brewers in the audience, I see. Okay, this is a hydrometer. And what a hydrometer is used for is particularly what this kind of hydrometer, so a small one, is used for if you're a home brewer and you're brewing your own beer and you need to figure out what the specific gravity of your liquid is, so how much sugar is actually still left in it, has fermentation finished, do you need to add more stuff to it, right? That's what you use a hydrometer for. Now, a hydrometer is not something that I could just hand you and say, here, go use that. There's a technique to how you read a hydrometer, which is why if you ever do any lab sciences, like the beginning part of your training as a lab scientist is just how to use the freaking equipment. Like, how do you make these things work? How do you look at this, right? There are skills involved with being able to properly read the instruments. Competent description using instruments requires training in how the instruments are supposed to be used. And in case you were wondering, if you're ever using a hydrometer and you're trying to take a specific gravity reading, the trick is you have to read the bottom of the meniscus and not the top of the meniscus. Just in case you're ever brewing your own beer, now you know. Point is that competent training requires you to be trained, competent description requires you to actually be trained in how to do it. If we know how to use the hydrometer and we get different readings, either one of us just looked at it wrong, or one of us still doesn't actually know how to read the thing properly. But as soon as we are in a situation where we have equal competence in reading it, we can't disagree. We will come to the same reading when we use the hydrometer. And we will come to the same reading because, once again, consensus about proper use of language, right, within the community. All of this stuff is conventional, right? There's nothing about a hydrometer reading or any other kind of instrument reading, or by analogy, any kind of application of a conceptual definition that somehow like fell from the heavens, right? We invented these things because they were useful to us. And we use them to do various things. But what is conventional here is not the outcome. What is conventional are the terms, right? To say that the hydrometer is conventional and there are conventions about how you read it and use it is not to say that you get to make up how much sugar is in your wort. And that's good, because if you make up the wrong number, then you're not gonna get good beer. You're gonna get crappy beer, trust me. I've been there. So there are ways that having competent skills, right, mean that the answer is no longer something that is individually negotiable. So conventionality, yes, individual idiosyncrasy, not necessarily. And that's important to keep in mind. The other thing that's really important to keep in mind is that when we are talking about facts, and we are talking about descriptions, we are not talking about explanations that are subsequently constructed utilizing those facts. The reason I have the stock photo of the business meeting, besides the fact that it was a stock photo and free and did not require me to pay any copyright, is to underscore the ways that an explanation, when we give an explanation, is a set of instructions or a recipe that we offer to one another. Explanations are not descriptions of anything. Explanations are literally steps that you're supposed to follow in order to produce some kind of outcome. Think about a cookbook, right? If I'm giving you a recipe in a cookbook, I'm not describing anything. I'm telling you what to do. I'm giving you a set of instructions as to how you should go about doing this. Now, there's different kinds of explanations, obviously, that we use, particularly across the social sciences. We'd use causal explanations where we try to make something happen. So a set of instructions about something, anarchy leading to balances of power is also a recipe for producing more balances of power, or less if you don't want balances of power. Right? So in explanations about how making something happen are causal explanations. That's sort of what we mean when we are talking about causation. When we're talking about interpretive explanations or explanations about how to go on, what are the rules, what is appropriate to do in certain kinds of circumstances. If I'm telling you that, that's another set of instructions that I'm giving to you to try to have an outcome that you're actually involved in producing. Right? None of these are facts. What they can do, and this is something I think Karl Popper got right, it's very rare for people who know me that I say something Karl Popper got right, but this is something I think Karl Popper got right. Explanations are not immediate derivations from sets of facts. The best you can do is say whether an explanation corresponds with the facts or not. whether it accords with or sort of conforms to the facts. As a number of other philosophers during the 20th century pointed out, any given set of facts can support multiple explanations, which means that when we're trying to debate whether something is a good explanation, we cannot simply fall back on questions of factuality, because the facts can support different kinds of explanations that go in very different sorts of directions. And one of the reasons I think we get this wrong is because so much, at least in international relations and political science, one of the reasons we get this wrong is because for many years we've kind of labored under the dominance of this sort of neo-positivist hypothesis testing way of thinking about knowledge as if that were just equal to science itself. And we think that looking at a general empirical claim and testing it against cross-case covariation to see if it's statistically significant is an explanation. It is not. That is not an explanation. It is a really good description of a pattern. Explanations are about case-specific productions of outcomes. And we need to be able to remember that then explanations are inherently more contestable than sets of facts on which they purport to be based. So if people start talking about explanations and they sort of claim that they're facts, nope, let's pull that back a little bit. You can always contest explanations. So if facts don't actually tell you what to do and they don't actually lead to specific kinds of explanations, what does? Well, remember earlier when I said that you should keep in mind that we don't entirely live in a disenchanted world. And part of the reason we don't, I think you should keep that in mind, is because, you know, I needed to throw up a Star Wars picture. What gives us the sort of impetus to actually do things if it's not facts? It's our stories that make the facts meaningful. You see resistance, I think, to the general disenchantment of the world in our popular culture, in the appeal of these sort of mythic stories, right? How much money did the latest Black Panther film make when it opened last week? What, 200 and some odd million dollars, like in the first 4 days? I mean, these films make huge amounts. People flock to these things. Why? Why do we flock to these things? In part, we flock to these things because they are compelling mythic stories, right? Why do people continue to watch even strange Star Wars franchises, right? Because it's like you want to know something more about that particular world. Stories are what is compelling because the stories make the facts meaningful, and they then give us the ability to say, okay, this is how we should go on. These are sort of moral stances we should take with respect to the facts and so on. Our explanations do something very similar to this, right? Our explanations draw on the facts but propel them in particular kinds of directions and should probably be evaluated a little bit more like the way we would evaluate stories. Yes, it's important to know whether your explanations that purport to be factual are based on facts and are not contradicted by them. Yes, that's important, but that's not enough. You always need more than that to be able to actually say, no, we've got a solid explanation here. The facts are really good for ruling out courses of action, but they're not necessarily going to tell you what the proper course of action is. That's where these stories come from. Why do people keep reading Lord of the Rings over and over again? Why did Amazon spend, what, $750 million to create the Rings of Power series? Right, because people are deeply invested in those mythic stories. And that shows us the limitations, I think, of this disenchanted privileging of science and fact. I have two more slides. And one of them, I would say I'm going to, you know, deal with the recurrent undead thing of the undead zombie here of relativism. But instead, I decided to go with the cute zombie because the cute zombie is more fun. I want to head off at the pass a possible objection to the analysis I've been offering. And that analysis that I've been offering is an analysis that sometimes is accused of being relativistic, as if somehow the way I'm talking about facts mean that things could be factual in different communities which would somehow contradict each other, and then A and not A could be true at the same time, and Aristotle would roll over in his grave and all of Western civilization would crumble and so on and so forth. And I'm not exaggerating, because I've had that particular accusation almost in those words thrown at this kind of account a number of times. I do think, to use the technical term, that objection is bullshit. And why I think that objection is problematic is because, you've got to think it out, if we have disagreement about facts, if we are both making factic claims and we are coming to what appear to be different conclusions, if facts are statements that competent speakers, descriptive claims that competent speakers can't disagree with, and we seem to disagree about them, then only one of four possible things could be the case. It is possible that one of us just read the instrument wrong. So that's a possibility. No relativism there, somebody's just wrong. We could be making the same claim using different words. I don't know, maybe in your particular regional dialect, the proper word for this is cat. Cool. Not in mine, but you know, maybe it's in yours. Great, we're saying the same thing, but we're using different words. Again, no relativism to worry about. We may just be talking past one another. We may be making claims that appear to be contradicting each other, but we're actually talking about different aspects of the same thing. You find this a lot in debates about like the democratic peace in international relations, and people are talking about democratic peace and they really don't mean the same thing as the other people they're arguing with, so they're all talking about slightly different things, they're just using the same word, democratic peace, all right? Or anarchy. Good Lord, there's as many anarchy as the many meanings of anarchy as there are IR theorists talking about anarchy, right? So, you know, maybe people are just talking past each other. Or, and here's the fourth one, which I think is in some ways the most interesting, the claim isn't actually a factic claim at all. It's an explanation, or it's a piece of poetry, it's something mythological, it's something entirely different. Again, no relativism, just very different kinds of things. And that leads me to my conclusion, which is what I think we, as people who are involved in one way or another in the knowledge business, in education, in teaching and learning, ought to be doing with respect to some of these strange controversies about fact. Because in many ways, I've said many times, and I will continue to say, probably until I retire and many years beyond that, that our most important impact, especially as faculty, is not on things that we write and say, but on students that we teach and in courses that we design. Right? This is really where the impact, I think, actually comes. We have a pedagogical role. So I'm going to propose to you that what we do is we treat some of these questions about facts and facticity and factuality pedagogically. And we take the fact that even in the notion of an alternative fact, we can see an affection for factuality, and we use that as a moment of teaching, right? A moment to actually bring people along in a slightly different way. I think it is incumbent on us to teach people to distinguish facts from non-facts in at least two ways, realizing that there are claims out there in politics, in social life, in international relations that are not actually factic claims and should not be evaluated in terms of whether or not they are factually accurate. That's not the function that they have. That's not an appropriate way of reading them. And then once we have decided that we are talking about a factic claim, well, then there are lots of different ways that we can evaluate factically true versus factically false or factically untrue claims. Science is not one thing. There are lots of different kinds of scientific approaches that all work within that factic discourse. One thing I think that is really not helpful to do is just to throw facts at people, particularly if I'm correct about the way that facts operate as linguistic consensuses within competent speakers, community of competent speakers. Me telling you that you're wrong about something you've just asserted as a fact is simply going to provoke you doubling down on whatever it was. That may not be the most helpful way to do it. So instead of simply delivering a fact, okay, you're claiming something that you think is a fact, I'm not sure that it is, let's try to take that apart a little bit. What do you think supports that? Let's explore the kind of evidence that you're bringing to bear. Let's see if there's a way that we can get you to maybe think a little bit more critically about this thing that you have accepted as a fact. Is that going to work in the short term? Probably not. In the medium term, I think it may be the only thing that works. I'm gonna stop there.
Thank you very much, Professor Jackson. I realize I should be thinking about IR, but now I'm thinking about what happens when online fandom communities treat stories as facts,
yeah,
and all the interesting things
we
that sets into
too.
Motion. But for the moment, I am going to turn over to Dr. Sophie Rosenberg.
Great. Well, thank you, Dr. Kate Millard, for organizing this event and for the opportunity to join this panel. It's really a great privilege to discuss this issue of such importance with such esteemed scholars. So my name is Dr. Sophie Rosenberg. I'm a fellow here at LSE in the International Relations Department, and I've come to this topic relatively recently. My previous research focus is more on human rights and states' kind of normative legal responsibilities to prevent and protect populations from mass atrocities. And the link between my past research and today's topic around the politics of truth and facts becomes apparent over the next few minutes. So my comments today primarily build upon Professor Jackson's 2021 article, I believe, in the journal Renewal, Populism and its Discontent, Alternative Facts, Scientific Claims, and Political Action, which I found extremely helpful. And if you haven't read it, please do. So my goal here today is just to make a few points, is to link the ideas in this article with the idea, with concepts of security, and I'll seek to bring the state back into the discussion. And I'll also lay out a few different approaches that I found I'm seeing how states are tackling the issue of what to do about harmful content online, including fake news, including disinformation, hate speech, and extremism. And I'll end with a question of whether truth should be seen as a right. So starting with this article, Professor Jackson presents a way to think about a common tactic that we find in politics today, weaponizing facticity. And what does this mean? It's referring to how the use of counterfeit facts that are intended to be treated as facts, as though they were impersonally true, when they are clearly not, thereby appropriating the epistemic authority of a fact for political partisan purposes. And you can find a pretty striking example of this just in the BBC, an interview with Carrie Lake, very popular news anchor who was running for governor of Arizona. And she gives an interview to the BBC. She lost her election, but many candidates have sowed doubt on the 2020 election results, and they have won. And according to New York Times analysis, in next year's House of Representatives, more than a third of the members have questioned or denied the 2020 election results. And it points to the importance of understanding the practice of weaponizing facticity. Now, when I first heard this panel was about factic claims, I thought there was an important gap in my knowledge. I wasn't really that familiar with the term, and I was somewhat relieved to read in your article that it's a relatively new term, but with an archaic, kind of a much earlier history. So I'd like to link that to a much more recent concept that was developed by a group of risk researchers at the University of Cambridge, the Alan Turing Institute, and the UK Ministry of Defence's Defence Science and Technology Laboratory. And you can find the report published in 2020. And it's that of epistemic security. So epistemic security refers to the processes by which societies access, produce, and distribute information, as well as their ability to evaluate the veracity of information. So it's a two-part concept. So an epistemically secure society is one that not only has the ability to generate and distribute and access reliable information, but also has the ability to assess the veracity of the information and the source reliability. So an epistemically secure society is one that reliably averts epistemic threats. So what are these? The Cambridge report, and I don't think this is an exhaustive list, they highlight blatant censorship efforts, misinformation campaigns, the erosion of trust in expertise, the suppression of diverse viewpoints and marginalized voices. And I think another epistemic threat that we can add is what Professor Jackson identifies as the strategies that are used to weaponize facticity for political purposes. So making claims as facts, even when they have been clearly shown not to be empirically validated, generates very widespread confusion about what it means for something to be a fact in the first place. And when we lose a clear understanding of what facts are, this jeopardizes the society's epistemic security, to use their term, weakening their ability to assess the veracity of information and the reliability of sources. So, to think more globally, where do we go from here? What do we do about this, and what are states doing about this? This is bringing the state back into the conversation. What should the states be doing? So the framing the issue as a security one is intriguing. On the one hand, we've seen many cases where there's a direct link between epistemic insecurity, disinformation, hate speech, extremism online, and threats to physical security. So the state clearly has some role to play. Think of the January 6th attack on the US Capitol. Think of the COVID-19 disinformation, misinformation conspiracy theories. And think of in situations of armed conflict in Myanmar, Ethiopia, and elsewhere, where harmful content spread by the state and non-state actors fueled political violence and mass atrocities. So given the spread of disinformation, conspiracy theories, harmful content, there's an emerging norm that states have a responsibility to protect their society, their users, from what is deemed harmful content. So they're developing norms on online content control domestically, and we're seeing efforts to develop normative consensus internationally. And this is taking place in the conversation of digital sovereignty questions, which you might be familiar with. States refer to their sovereign right to control online content. And they're setting up, you know, frameworks, new legislation, new task forces, new government bodies that are purportedly aimed to curb harmful content. This is, of course, really, really tricky. So we know that when an issue is securitized, it can justify emergency measures, it can enhance state authority to protect against a threat. So the way in which states implement this increasingly popular normative commitment to protecting users from harmful content varies significantly across the world, and it can justify protective or repressive policies. And key questions that you might be thinking that determine how states implement this sovereign right, but what constitutes harmful content? What constitutes appropriate measures to enforce it, to protect users? What is the purpose, really? What are the collateral effects? What are the power dynamics in determining these questions? What's the relationship between political interests of governments with commercial interest of tech companies and social media platforms? And we can think about this in kind of two ways on a spectrum. I'm not saying that liberal democracies follow one and authoritarian states follow the other. I think there's a spectrum there. And I think the really interesting countries where this is really the fault lines are being drawn in a very interesting way are not Beijing or Washington. It's more India, Brazil, Turkey, Nigeria, Indonesia, large democracies, huge markets, democratic fragility questions. So one approach is the notion of information security. So this idea that individuals are protected from threats, destructive, negative impacts on the information space. And Danielle Flonk has a really good article about this in International Affairs. And this enables states to expand their authority, to restrict information. You have internet shutdowns, for instance, website filtering. And they justify this to protect users from harmful content. So they're becoming more frequent, lasting longer, much more targeted as well. And you see governments creating new rules about having more power over tech companies. So in India, for instance, in 2021, India passed legislation that enables the government to order Twitter to remove content and block accounts. And holding company executives criminally liable for speech that appears on their services, leveraging the threat of withdrawing their authority to operate, claiming this is to counter online misinformation. But Twitter was told to remove content related to civil liberties and press freedom, the government's handling of the pandemic. And they're actually suing the Indian government right now. Now, whether this is going to continue is a huge question mark on future management. But
whether Twitter is going to continue is a huge question.
So this facilitates states' measures to alter perceptions of established truth and facts, our ability to determine the veracity of information. So you have, you know, cyber troops, informational propaganda, electronic armies, as they say, of bots, of humans to censor and to flood the online ecosystem with disinformation or distracting content. So on the other side is the vision of epistemic security. Enhancing access to a wide range of information and enhancing users' abilities to evaluate the veracity of information. So what does this look like? I think it looks like not identifying the threat substantively in the sense of this is hate speech, this is disinformation, this is a conspiracy theory, but more on harms to the epistemic processes, so censorship and eroding trust and expertise in disinformation campaigns. So it looks like enhancing users' right to access information and freedom of expression. And I can go into this more clearly, but enhancing users' resilience to information manipulation, algorithmic transparency, helping them understand what their online epistemic experiences is crafted by. So to wrap up, And I want to pass the floor. I'll leave you with a question. Is there a right to truth? Should there be a right to truth? So the right to truth already exists in international human rights law, but it refers to human rights, the right to know what happened in case of mass atrocities, the right to know what happened, to a family member or a member of a community. But what happens when this idea travels more broadly? How broadly should it be conceptualized? And what are the risks in this, in a time where fake news and disinformation are seen as detrimental to democracy? So I'll leave you with this question, and I'll pass you the floor.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Yes, please. And now some comments from Professor Laura Stoberg.
Is your mic on?
I don't know. Do I have to stay at this? Is the mic necessary for the online? Yes.
It is. It should be on.
Okay.
Just because hers doesn't have a green.
Yeah. All right.
Maybe we'll just shift this one over towards
you. Man, that means I have to sit still. okay. I can manage to sit still, but if it looks like I'm trying to get out of my chair, it's because I am. Okay. So this title is almost made for a particular argument that Patrick and I have been having for about 2 decades, in which I usually start my response by saying, let's talk about sex. And here, maybe I would start my response by saying, let's talk about fantasy.
Okay, cool.
Since, it's half the title, and especially since some days I would like to make the argument that fantasy and desire are perhaps the only facts, an argument to which I am very attracted. Ha ha, no, not funny. Academic jokes. But actually today, Patrick has attracted me to arguing with him on his own grounds. Ooh. I know, never happened before. Probably gonna lose, but gonna give it a shot. Okay, so my suggestion is that Patrick's presentation makes two assumptions that, were they true, the presentation would be awesome, but they're not. And I'm gonna try and convince him of that, which is not gonna work, and try to convince you of that. It might work, I don't know. So the two assumptions are, number one, that the only or modal or most likely to be weaponized facts are the false alternative or counterfeit ones. Mm. And number two, that the fact non-fact dichotomy is politically and intellectually benign. So I'm going to tell you why I think both of those claims are false and then why I think it matters. So the idea that facts, and particularly alternative facts, can be and are weaponized, I completely agree. In fact, there was a 2018 article in Perspectives on Politics in which Bob Cohen called, well, me, you, and Sammy, people who use alternative facts, which was very sweet. and then kind of said that your facts are dangerous and my facts are not, right? And in some sense, then presuming all of the conditions of factness in your article, I mean, here, he's wrong, but pretending he was not, right? Like, technically, he believes he is weaponizing the true facts against the false facts, right? And even if we are to take that there are true facts and false facts, which some days I'll agree, some days, it is also possible to weaponize the true facts and to use those true facts in ways that harm people, in ways that disenfranchise people, in ways that delegitimize people's psychological experiences, in ways that delegitimize people's emotions, in ways that delegitimize their politics and their history. My personal favorite was a Time magazine article about 10 years ago that had the apparent revelation that Hutu and Tutsi are not ethnicities, which is factually true. In any agreed upon language and things like that. But of course, it was being used in that article to suggest the irrationality of people on both sides of that conflict. In other words, they should know that it's not an ethnicity, learn that it's not an ethnicity, and then stop feeling things about that ethnicity. Right? So true facts can also be weaponized to people's harm, which I think is important because when you think about it that way, it's not a question of necessarily any of the conditions of wrongness or misreading or disagreement. Something can both be true and harmful to people. And to the extent that it can both be true and harmful to people, and it can be used kind of in a weaponized intent, then to me, I'm a little bit afraid of the second half of my argument, which is the fact-non-fact dichotomy. Okay, so my problem with the fact-non-fact dichotomy is not many of the legitimate arguments that Patrick and others make about the ways in which the world without facts is a scary place, and one in which there's an intellectual anarchy that could be dangerous, although the world in which there are facts is also, to me, a scary place. And the reason it's a scary place is because the fact-non-fact dichotomy is not one in which the two things are equal. So like a fact and a desire or a fantasy or something that you may say is non-factic, right, are not held equal in discourses, particularly in politics, but also in other areas of social and political life. So the idea that you have a factic discussion and a not factic discussion, and that's just a dichotomy that we can make in intellectual terms, I think ignores a power politics of factness, which is actually necessary to start to make Patrick's argument, but then doesn't end up at the end of it, I think, right? Because like if you think about that there is a, I would say, fetish power around facts, you can use a different word if you want. I just like to use those words when I can. Then that means that when I say X is a fact and Y is not a fact, it means X is better than Y. Even if I don't mean that, and even if I disagree, right? So like, I've kind of let go that I think that like fantasies and desires are cooler than facts, right? But nonetheless, if I come to you and I say it is a fact that, then that attaches a normative power to that idea that it is a fantasy that does not have. I might have different normative power, different crowds, you know, something like that, but it doesn't have the same normative power. So the inequality between facts and non-facts and the potential for weaponizing true facts, I think, causes a significant problem normatively for the argument that may empirically make sense. And I think that that also brings up my last argument kind of about this, which is that there's kind of a 2.5 assumption behind this, the assumption that we have agreed on a communicative language. Right? And I think that the reason, so like, I'm joking that I think your code is a cat, although it's cuter than most cats because I'm not a cat person. But I think Twitter will kill me now. but that's okay, Twitter will go away soon and we'll all be fine. But at the same time, I think that the cat non-cat dichotomy is a fairly easy one. Whereas the, for example, question of authority or of anarchy or of rights or of identity group membership is not one on which we have the sort of linguistic wholeness, right, of the cat. And so given that, it, that problem can then run through, you know, for example, I have phrased my factual argument differently than you phrased your factual argument, which means that even if we're making the same factual argument in different terms, it also has different political kind of value or weaponization and different normative implications. So to me, I guess, in theory, cool. But in practice, I'm a little worried about kind of the other implications of the argument. So, I've decided I would end with, since you started with music, I figured I'd end with it and would show our comparative depth, which is, I was thinking about the fantasy world word, and I thought maybe it's a love story, just say yes.
Thank you so much to the whole panel. I am now fascinated by this sort of, I think, cross-cutting theme of to what degree facts and then factness speaks for itself in ways that exceed our control even with the best of intentions, and what the absolutely terrifying implications that might hold for Sophie's work on the state's attempt to regulate how we might determine something called truth or something called factness, particularly if Patrick and Laura cannot agree. I think in the interest of fair chairing, I'm going to turn over to Patrick for a response to Laura and some reflections on Sophie's comments. And then, friends, I am going to turn over to you for the balance of the Q&A, because I am guessing that you want to hear what Patrick is going to respond as well. So if you have questions, we're going to come to you immediately. We're going to take 3 or 4 all in one go. But first,
yeah,
please, Patrick.
Cool. No, thanks. Both marvelous responses of pulling out sort of other dimensions of this. There's sort of endless permutations of things with this topic. I want to react to one thing that Sophie said that I think connects nicely to Laura's skepticism about the agreement on a common language. And I want to use that as an opportunity to kind of clarify what I mean by we have consensus about a communicative language. Consensus about a communicative language is not legislated from the top and then enforced by penalty. That's not consensus about a communicative language. That's newspeak. That's a slightly different way of going about this. When I speak to someone, I necessarily presume that they are a competent speaker and that I am too. Otherwise, I wouldn't be using words in particular ways. I use the words. The words follow in a set of, they go along with sort of my understanding of how grammar is supposed to work and so on. This is not a precise, formalized way of doing things. We can negotiate this. We can sort of work this out in practice. But the consensus part about speaking isn't as simple as consulting some kind of a rule book about what language is supposed to be. So I share the skepticism about getting sovereign states involved in kind of policing what is necessary for there to be sort of good speech, or what I really would prefer the state not determine what good information is for me to take a look at, because that seems a little scary. But I'm not sure that epistemic security does much better, because as we know, and this is picking up on a point that Laura made as well, security is not a neutral word. And as soon as you start tossing security around, it has sets of political implications, and now we can kind of get away with things because, oh, security's at stake. So, goodness, we need epistemic security. Not just epistemic soundness or something, but not just critical thinking. We need epistemic security. Now this starts to sound something that the state can get itself involved in a little bit more. And that worries me a little bit, because again, I think what we're really talking about here are these sets of a little more free-flowing negotiations that we make on a day-to-day communicative basis. So the consensus should not be understood as some kind of big overarching piece of structure that kind of imposes itself on us. I'll say, can I say one more thing to Laura in particular? Mm-hmm. So I largely buy your first point about true facts being able to be weaponized, but I think you have seen through to something I'm trying to do here that I wasn't very explicit about, which is I have this fantasy that fact and non-fact, factic and non-factic claims could be treated as somehow on the same level, doing different kinds of things. I freely admit that that is not a rational empirical judgment that I think is likely to actually come to pass, except in the strange rarefied atmosphere of higher educational institutions, where we can sort of approximate this, right, by ways of doing this. No, gosh, we never do this in churches. And I know of what I know whereof I speak, with my wife being a pastor. Churches are not set up for this kind of thing. But I do think that one of the implications of the analysis that I've given is that we should, in fact, be treating some of these things not as fact is automatically better. The Hutu Tutsi thing, it's not the fact that's the problem. It's the story that they told about it and the particular conclusions they tried to draw from it as if facts had logical and inevitable conclusions for action, which, if I'm right, they don't. And that in that gap is where there could be more interesting politics.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. I have so many questions about power, but I would like to know, friends, what your questions are. And so if you have a question for the panel, please raise your hand. I will select questions in rounds. Normal reminder to keep questions succinct, and to state your name and affiliation, please. So.
And I reserve the right to have you be quiet if you stand up and say, this is more of a comment than a question.
Hand?
You got a hand down front.
Oh, I apologize. Yes, here, please. Thank you. And if there are others, we'll take a couple questions. And I'm going to reserve the right to come back to the other two panelists to comment on Patrick's response as well. Sorry. Yep. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My name is Remy Meehan, and I'm a grad student in the International Strategy and Diplomacy program. Thank you all for your comments. I had a question for Professor Jackson. How can you tell if a claim is factic? And what do you do if two people disagree about whether a claim is factic?
Excellent question. Very complex one. Any others?
There's one in the back as well?
Yes, please. In the middle, and then at the back of the room as well, and then we will come back for a response. Thank you very much.
Peter Wilson, Department of International Relations. I like the idea of counterfeit facts. I wasn't aware of it before. If somebody puts forward a counterfeit fact, are they always aware of the fact that they're doing it? In which case, they're being dishonest. Sophie mentioned the Kerry Lake BBC interview. I watched that too, and I concluded that she was being dishonest. She was being disingenuous. The best you could say about her from that interview, that she was prepared to accept a number of smaller untruths for a greater truth. The greater truth being something along the lines of we need to make America great again, whatever that means, and we have to make some sacrifices to truth along the way. But it seems to me that people who put forward counterfeit facts are being dishonest.
Thank you very much. And then one more question in the back row, please. Thank you.
Hi, thanks guys. I thought like all of your comments were super cool. I'm Amy, and I'm a MSc student on the IR research program, yes. And I had a question sort of about like facts and non-facts as a binary, or like the transition between the two states. So I think something like identity group claims, like the Hutus and Tutsis, for instance, although, you know, you said that it is true that they did not have any like biological sort of basis for this sort of grouping, but could we sort of think about like transitioning from like and a baseless ethnicity claims that was a false claim to something like gradually with a buy-in effect of more and more people believe this, then it becomes true. Then there is that sort of like transition from like a non-fact to a fact, right? So would you guys say that there was like a hard cutoff point in the situation where there is a binary, or are we always in that sort of nebulous state of like, are these facts or non-facts at all? Thanks.
Thank you so much. It's an excellent question. All really excellent questions. I'm going to start with Professor Jackson and then come back around on various dimensions of the relationship, I think, between fact and truth.
Yeah. Good stuff. Good sets of questions all around. It's 50.1%. There's no cutoff in my way of thinking about this. So the idea of a fact is that it would be completely incontrovertibly impersonal for all the competent speakers of that particular language community. In practice, we rarely get to those things. Part of the reason why I was using the cat coat example is because I actually think that there are many fewer facts out there than we believe that there are, because we get confused and we claim that these things have the authority of fact when they don't. They just maybe have the authority of a certain amount of popular consensus or expert consensus or something along those lines. That those aren't actually bad. They're sort of maybe on the way toward being a fact, but they're not actually there. When you get to the point that it's a fact, then there isn't any disagreement sort of possible, and when you're still a competent speaker. One of the implications of this is that most of the things we operate with in these sorts of discussions aren't actually facts. And so we should stop treating them as if they were, and we should sort of examine what else makes them powerful, what else makes them compelling, which speaks back to the first question about knowing whether a claim is factic or not. At the risk of sounding punny, whether a claim is factic or not is not a factic question, because different communities may read a particular claim in a different sort of way. It is possible, and I know because Laura and I have done this, we have read, say, Bob Cohen's comments in 2018 as comedy, or we have read it as poetry, or we have read it as some other things. And so different communities can sort of read and put a different construal on a set of claims. And I think that's a perfectly legit thing that we kind of do all the time. I think sometimes within particular forms of life, we have little clues that we can use to kind of come to rough consensus about what sort of thing something is. So claims that are showing up from the pulpit at church are probably not going to be factic in quite the same way, right? So but this is, again, this is conventional in terms of the way we put this down. There's always an opportunity for sort of hermeneutic pushback on exactly how we should be reading a particular claim. My only logical point is that if we've decided we're going to treat a claim as factic, certain kinds of things follow from that.
May I ask, clarify, yeah, if factic claims and knowledge claims are the same in the way you're thinking about this?
No.
Can you say a little bit more?
Yeah. I'm sorry to disappoint people who know kinds of talks that I give, but there was a 2x2 that was on a slide that I didn't show for
indeed,
sake of time.
Some of my students have read it.
there's actually a couple different 2x2s, but there's the science one from the kind of inquiry book, but there's another one who's sort of contrasting factic claims with other modes of knowing. And that I actually used that in there was a piece I did in Millennium a few years ago where I have that particular 2x2 appears. And no, I would not say that factic claims and knowledge are necessarily the same, with the following caveat. In a disenchanted world, Laura's absolutely right, claims about fact are not on the same level, kind of politically speaking, as others, because we have this sort of slanted environment that we are playing in. Part of what I am hoping to do is to unslant the environment a little bit. So I don't think we're talking just about all kinds of knowledge claims. Peter's question about sort of the psychology of the purveyor of the alternative fact. On the one hand, I think it's a fascinating question that could probably only be answered like biographically with particular individuals. On the other hand, I don't really want to get to know Kellyanne Conway well enough to know what she thinks. Like, at some level, I don't care. And the reason I don't care is because I'm more interested in the epistemic status of the claim and the power that it has than I am in the individual reasons why particular people come to it. If I take that concern off for a second, I would bet you're probably right that a lot of these people standing up there know full well what they're doing, and they just don't care. And they are, in the precise and technical Harry Frankfurt sense, bullshitting. They're using speech without regard for its veracity. They're using it only for its effect.
Thank you very much, Patrick. Sophie, I would love to hear your thoughts as well on this truth-fact relationship. Just solve philosophy, ideally.
Yeah, cool.
No, I'm interested in the last question that Pierre-Olsen asked. And I wonder, when we're talking about weaponizing facticity, we're talking about, and in the case that you mentioned in the article and the Carrie Lake and the Kellyanne Conway, there's a power, there's a responsibility that comes with a certain position of power as well.
Yeah.
And so is it the same when a voter or somebody in the public shares the counterfeit fact as a political elite who has a much greater responsibility towards at least the to facticity or to the idea of facts in the first place?
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting thing.
That is an interesting question.
You could consider.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I claim no responsibility for my counterfeit facts. So it's not the fact that's the problem, it's how it's used. My argument is that the problem is the ability to call it a fact, because it can be weaponized because it is factual, right? Like, otherwise the claim that you can't be Hutu or Tutsi wouldn't have the same weight in the article if it couldn't be called a fact. Right? And that's my concern, is that calling something a fact imbues it with a weaponizability that is a problem for me. But you disagree.
Well, I disagree because consider the alternative.
I like the alternative.
But the alternative is a world in which we have no epistemic basis to say Kellyanne Conway is bullshitting.
Sure.
She just has alternative facts.
Right, but if the axis on which we were debating was not facts at all, and it was like, who can I attract?
Okay.
I like that one.
See, at that point, and we, again, we've been,
this
Laura,
is
the, as Laura said, we've been arguing about this for a long time. this is where, unsurprisingly, I think back to Weber, right? And to Weber's understanding of the vocation of science. And Weber points out, and I'm not quoting here, but I think this is an extrapolation from Weber's position, if science becomes just another form of politics, it will get swamped by the political parties that are much better set up to do this than we are. In order for science to have any kind of power, it has to not be part of partisan politics, as problematic as that is. It needs to be something separate. And what is the currency on which we trade is the notion that there is some kind of epistemic distinction to what it is that we're producing. The name for that in our post-Enlightenment European USian tradition is fact. And I think it would be deeply problematic for us to just dissolve that or blow it up.
See, I think that where we disagree is that I think they're actually not separable, but we pretend that they are. And then when we pretend that they are, that has all the implications that I'm worried about. But that's, of course, our fundamental disagreement.
Yeah.
I would like to hear more about this, but I also want to check with our friends in the audience if we have further questions. They don't necessarily have to be about Weber.
I'm also very happy to talk about Andor. Or
Wittgenstein,
Lord of the Rings,
Rings of Power, we've got it all. But we'll do one more round, and we'll try and get a bunch in. So if you do have questions, please hands up. And it makes sense, I think, to come this way. So we'll start at the back of the room and then work in this direction. And please be succinct, because we're just going to take like five all at once and then just have some blockbuster comments. Thank you so much.
Hadrian Saperstein, I'm a second-year PhD student in the IR department. I've been trying to formulate my question, and I'm having quite a hard time getting it. So this is kind of what I'll say, which is, David Hume has actually worked quite a bit on the idea of association of facts, right? The matters of facts. And he essentially has three principles of these associations of facts. I was just curious, because this has been quite a long time since I've read it, and I was trying to quickly read on it. If you had kind of, Dr. Jackson, if you had looked at Hume's as a way of kind of articulating your points.
Yeah.
Thank you. And then I saw the next hand here, I think on the end of the row. Yeah, thank you.
Good evening. My name is Alexander Rodriguez. I'm a master's student at LSE. My question is, in brief, if competency can vary among speakers, who has the power to determine competency? Yeah. Whose dictionary triumphs and why?
And then I think we had two here in the middle of the third row. We'll just borrow some cooperation. Thank you all.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Professor. My name is Shireen, and I'm a PhD student in the IR department as well. You briefly mentioned about the same fact leading to different explanations as well. And if you just talk a little bit more about how that plays into political discussions and how different political explanations can derive from the same fact and the role of power within it as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Albert. I'm a PhD student here at the IR department as well. And we, in all this conversation, assuming that we do have access to facts, right? And isn't that an assumption of an objective reality as well? No?
He doesn't think so.
I don't think so, but yes, I can answer that.
So the thing is, for example, there were only yesterday there were these two factic claims about the missiles on Poland. Yep. So were they Ukrainian, were they Russian? So do we have access to that?
Excellent question. And then we have one more in the front row. And then I will turn back to the panel for final thoughts, and then I will thank everybody.
I have a question for Dr. Sjoberg. Yes, so you responded to Dr. Jackson's argument by saying that that produces some kind of superiority of facts over known facts, something that, like, facts are treated in a superior way, in a better way than known facts. But doesn't this argument imply a politicization of a question which is purely philosophical?
And is that a distinction? Friends, you have helpfully all asked questions about relativism, which is great. Thank you so much.
Good deal. Okay, quickly. Hume goes a little bit of the way. Wittgenstein goes much further. And there is, and we can talk about this later perhaps, I think there's an essential continuity between Hume's understanding of the common world and Wittgenstein's understanding of common linguistic practice. But Hume is less sharp about language, I think, than Wittgenstein is. So, but there's certainly some continuity there. Plus, a lot of the misunderstanding of how causation works is Hume's fault. So, or at least the fault of people reading Hume and reading Hume badly. Whose dictionary? So, I said at the beginning of my remarks that I wasn't going to be talking about the sociology of knowledge. Whose dictionary is a sociological question? It is exactly the kind of thing that we should be then analyzing if we know that the winning out of one set of terms over another cannot be reduced to a matter of fact. There must be something else going on as to why we arrive at which consensus we arrive at. And how we arrive at that consensus and how those consensi are maintained. No, it'd be consensuses, wouldn't it? Yeah. But.
Language.
Yeah, but that, you know what I mean. The how one comes to a consensus is irrelevant to the logical status of claims made within the consensus. And so if you're going to question the basis on which the consensus was produced, I think that can have effects, but it doesn't change the logical status of the fact that's articulated within that particular consensus. So there's a really interesting set of empirical sociological questions about why we come to prefer certain kinds of terms, and why certain we's come to prefer certain kinds of terms and then kind of impose it on other people. And I think there's a really interesting set of discussions that go on there. It is, however, necessarily the case, I would say, that if we're going to have those discussions, we have to first start out with the idea that there are such things as facts so that we could disagree about how those processes worked in ways that are not just our opinion, right? And then we would be able to say, now we can actually have kind of empirical analysis of how it is these things come. My suspicion is that it has nothing to do with the intrinsic power of particular kinds of formulations, because in response to gentleman up here, I don't actually think that it makes any sense for us to say that our language does or does not reflect some sort of mind in an independent external world. Not whether it does or doesn't, I just think it makes any sense to say that it does or doesn't, because where would you be standing when you were making a decision about whether your language actually reflected a mind-independent world? Logically, you'd have to be standing somewhere, you have to use language, and therefore you'd still be inside, so you wouldn't be outside, right? How can you possibly say that? So I think when we're talking about facts, we're talking about linguistic consensuses that are, in that sense, wholly internal to speech communities. And I think that those are the kinds of things that we should be sort of putting our attention on, which is why the politics of the dictionary would not be about intrinsic inherent properties of vocabularies. We couldn't say, to quote Thomas Kuhn, it's meaningless to say that a particular vocabulary, even a particular scientific vocabulary, is more or less true in the sense that it more or less approximates reality. That's not what's interesting. What's interesting is, what do we do with the vocabulary? How does the vocabulary function in practice? And I think that's really what I'm kind of driving us to, is we should really be focusing on precisely those kinds of questions. And that is exactly where the politics happens, right? How is it that we end up being able to say, you know, even if we all agreed on a fact, like the missiles that landed in Poland were not fired by Russians. Let's imagine that we actually had full-on factual consensus about that. That fact itself does not tell us, because they are still missiles that are of Russian extraction, because that's one of the things we know, then it doesn't tell us whether we should be sort of still angry at the Russians about this, or whether we should be invoking Article 5 or not invoking Article 5, or what our responses should be, or as the son of the evil emperor said on Twitter the other day, this is not a direct quote, but this is Donald Trump Jr. saying, gosh, now that Russian missiles have landed in Poland, or missiles from Ukraine have landed in Poland, we should stop funding the Ukrainians because they attacked a sovereign NATO ally. Like, complete insanity. But that, you could take the very same set of descriptive observations and do very, very different things with them. And I think that's treating those different things not as facts and not as exhausted by the facts, I think, is what actually opens up the sets of discussions that we ought to be having, as opposed to saying that we could somehow sweep them all under the factic rug and say, the scientists will figure that out. No, this is not actually ultimately a factic question.
Wonderful. So I'm here. Last remarks from Sophie on the sociology of truth and how it relates to power. And then we're going to hear from Laura on the last word on the politics of philosophy.
To build on this point about the case of the Ukrainian missiles, so I think we always have to be really consciously aware of the limitations of our access to the facts, and to be actively, consciously thinking what are the constraints to our access to facts, and how should that shape our response to it. But that doesn't mean we can't have access to the fact on a more abstract level. And I think that points to a bigger question about, comfort with uncertainty.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of the power of conspiracy theories and are based on this desire to quench quenching our desire for certainty, and that makes it possible for these conspiracy theories to be quite convincing. And so, and I think that comes back to the education
bit.
Innate education not only being a way to help figure out what how facts are made and evidence and all this, but also increasing our comfort with not knowing, and having that be an important thing to think about.
Yeah,
such a good point.
Yeah. Channeling Anne Tickner and Cynthia Enloe and Christine Sylvester, there is no such thing as anything that is apolitical. It is simply that the politics are not admitted or hidden or an assumed consensus. rather than that there's a political philosophy and I'm politicizing it, right? I am politicizing it, but I'm politicizing the apoliticalness that it hides, which is why I think that this, I'm talking about the philosophy of knowledge and not the sociology of knowledge, is a problematic dichotomy, because the sociology of it has normative implications for the philosophy, which then means that, so like, for example, okay, so the world in which you can say, you know, there's no such thing as a factic disagreement, right? Mm-hmm. So if philosophically that is true, it may still be normatively bad to say because of the sociology of knowledge around it. So my argument is they can't break up because otherwise they're never getting back together, second Taylor Swift reference. And that's it for me.
Never, ever, ever getting back together.
No. All right, thank you. All right, so you have preempted me in thanking very much our wonderful speakers who I, and I'm sure you, have enjoyed listening to this evening, Professor Patrick Jackson, Dr. Sophie Rosenberg, Professor Laura Schoberg. Also like to thank our event organizer, Katie Hill, as well as the event and AV team that has been assisting us so ably this evening. And of course, I would like to thank you for sharing your time with us this evening. Have a great night.
I didn't realize you were such a Swiftie.
It's the only cool country music now.